If that small, jerky motion advanced to a constant tremor, it would be the end of any non-wandless magic for the defense professor. Wandwork had no room for trembling fingers. How much that would actually handicap Professor Quirrell, if at all, Harry couldn't guess. The defense professor was certainly capable of wandless magic, yet still tended to use a wand for larger things. But for him, that might only be a convenience.
"Insanity," said Professor Quirrell as he carefully sipped from his tea.
He was looking at the teacup, not at Harry, which was unusual for him.
"Can be a signature all of its own."
The defense professor's small office was silent. The sound warded room quiet in a way the headmaster's office never could be. Sometimes the two of them both happened to finish exhaling or inhaling at the same time, and then there was an auditory emptiness that was almost a sound in itself.
"I'll agree with that in one sense," Harry said. "If someone tells me that everyone is staring at them and that their underwear is being dusted with thought-controlling powder, I know they're psychotic, because that's the standard signature of psychosis. But if you tell me that anything confusing points to Albus Dumbledore as a suspect, that seems overreaching. Just because I can't see a purpose doesn't mean there is no purpose."
"Purposeless," said Professor Quirrell. "Oh, but the madness of Dumbledore is not that he is purposeless, but that he has too many purposes. The headmaster might have planned this to make Lucius Malfoy throw away his game for vengeance on you, or it might be a dozen other plots. Who knows what the headmaster thinks he has reason to do, when he has found reason to do so many strange things already."
Harry politely declined tea, even knowing that Professor Quirrell would know what it meant. He considered bringing his own can of soda, but had decided against that as well, after realizing how easy it would be for the defense professor to teleport in a bit of potion, even if the two of them couldn't touch each other with direct magic.
"I have seen a little now of Dumbledore," Harry said. "Unless everything I've seen is a lie, I find it difficult to believe that he would plot to send any Hogwarts student to Azkaban. Ever."
"Ah,"
the defense professor said softly, the tiny reflection of the teacup gleaming in his pale eyes.
"But perhaps that is another signature, Mr. Potter. You have not yet comprehended the perspective of a man like Dumbledore. If he must, in some sufficiently noble cause, sacrifice a student, why, who would he choose but she who declared herself a heroine?"
That gave Harry some pause. It might just be hindsight bias, but that did seem to concentrate some of that hypothesis' probability mass onto framing Hermione in particular. Similarly, Professor Quirrell had predicted in advance that Dumbledore might target Draco.
"But if it's you behind all of this, Professor, you might have shaped your plans to frame the headmaster, and taken care to cast suspicion on him in advance."
The concept of evidence had something of a different meaning when you were dealing with someone who had declared themselves to play the game at one level higher than you.
"I see your point, Professor,"
Harry said evenly, giving no hints of his other thoughts.
"So, you think it's most probable that it was the headmaster who framed Hermione?"
"Not necessarily, Mr. Potter."
Professor Quirrell drained his teacup in one swallow and then set it down, the cup making a sharp rap as it descended.
"There is also Severus Snape, though what he might think to gain from this I could not guess. Thus he is not my prime suspect either."
"Then who is?"
Harry said, somewhat puzzled. Professor Quirrell surely wasn't about to reply, "You know who."
"The orders have a rule," said Professor Quirrell. "Investigate the victim. Many would-be criminals imagine that if they are the apparent victims of a crime, they shall not be suspected. So many criminals imagine it, indeed, that every senior order has seen it a dozen times over."
"You're not seriously trying to convince me that Hermione..."
The defense professor was giving Harry one of those slit-eyed looks that meant he was being stupid.
"Draco?"
Draco had been interrogated under Veritaserum, but Lucius might have had enough control to subvert auras to... Oh.
"You think Lucius Malfoy set up his own son?"
Harry said.
"Why not?" Professor Quirrell said softly. "From Mr. Malfoy's recorded testimony, Mr. Potter, I gather that you enjoyed some success in changing Mr. Malfoy's political views. If Lucius Malfoy learned of that earlier, he might have decided that his former heir had become a liability."
"I don't buy it," Harry said flatly.
"You are being wantonly naive, Mr. Potter. The history books are full of family disputes turned murderous for inconveniences and threats far less than those which Mr. Malfoy posed to his father. I suppose next you will tell me that Lord Malfoy of the Death Eaters is far too gentle to wish his son such harm."
A tinge of heavy sarcasm.
"Well, yes, frankly," Harry said. "Love is real, Professor. A phenomenon with observable effects. Brains are real, emotions are real, and love is as much a part of the real world as apples and trees. If you made experimental predictions without taking parental love into account, you'd have a heck of a time explaining why my own parents didn't abandon me at an orphanage after the incident with the science project."
The defense professor did not react to this at all. Harry continued.
"From what Draco says, Lucius prioritized him over important Wizengamot votes. That's significant evidence, since there's less expensive ways to fake love, if you just want to fake it. And it's not like the prior probability of a parent loving their child is low. I suppose it's possible that Lucius was just taking on the role of a loving father, and that he renounced that role after he learned Draco was consorting with Muggleborns. But as the saying goes, Professor, one must distinguish possibility from probability."
"All the better the crime," the defense professor said,
still in that soft tone,
"if no one would believe it of him."
"And how would Lucius even memory charm Hermione in the first place, without setting off the wards? He's not a professor." "Oh, right. You think it's Professor Snape."
"Wrong," said the defense professor. "Lucius Malfoy would trust no servant with that mission. But suppose some Hogwarts professor, intelligent enough to cast a well-formed memory charm, but of no great fighting ability, is visiting Hogsmeade. From a dark alley, the black-clad form of Malfoy steps forth. He would go in person for this, and speaks to her a single word."
"Imperio?"
"Legilimens, rather," said Professor Quirrell. "I do not know if the Hogwarts wards would trigger for a returning professor under the Imperius curse. And if I do not know, Malfoy probably does not know either. but Malfoy is a perfect Occlumens at least. He might be able to use legitimacy. And for the target, perhaps Aurora Sinistra. None would question the astronomy professor moving about at night.
Or even more obviously, Professor Sprout, said Harry, since she's the last person anyone would suspect.
The defense professor hesitated minutely.
Perhaps.
Actually,
Harry said then, putting a thoughtful frown on his face,
I don't suppose you know, offhand, if any of the current professors at Hogwarts were around back when Mr. Hagrid got framed in 1943?
Dumbledore taught transfiguration, Kettleburn taught magical creatures, and Vector taught arithmancy,
Professor Quirrell said at once.
And I believe that Bathsheba Babbling, now of ancient runes, was then a Ravenclaw prefect. But, Mr. Potter, there is no reason to suspect that anyone besides you-know-who was involved in that affair.
Harry shrugged artfully.
Seemed worth asking the question, just to check. Anyway, Professor, I agree it's possible that some outsider legitimized a member of the Hogwarts staff, and then obliviated them afterward. There's no way anyone would forget that part. But I don't think Lucius Malfoy is a probable candidate for the mastermind. It's possible, but not probable, that all of Lucius's apparent love for Draco was just a sense of duty, and that it all went up in a puff of smoke. It's possible, though not probable, that everything Lucius did in front of the Wizengamot was just an act. People's outsides do not always resemble their insides, like you said, but there's one piece of evidence that doesn't fit at all.
And that would be,
said the defense professor, his eyes half-lidded.
Lucius tried to reject 100,000 galleons for Hermione's life. I saw how surprised the Wizengamot was when Lucius said he was refusing it, despite the rules of honour. The Wizengamot didn't expect that of him. Why wouldn't he just take the money while acting all indignant and pretending to grit his teeth? He wouldn't actually care that much about throwing Hermione into Azkaban.
There was a pause.
Perhaps the role he was playing ran away with him, said Professor Quirrell. It does happen, Mr. Potter, in the heat of the moment.
Perhaps,
Harry said,
but it's still one more improbability to be postulated. And by the time you've had to add up that many excuses in a theory, it can't be at the top of the list anymore. Anything else in particular you think I ought to think about, within the range of all other possibilities?
There was a long silence. The defense professor's eyes dropped down to look at the empty teacup before them, seeming unusually distant.
I suppose I can think of one final suspect,
the defense professor said at last. Harry nodded. The defense professor didn't seem to notice, but only spoke on.
Has the headmaster told you anything, even a hint, about Professor Trelawney's prophecy?
Huh? Harry said automatically, converting his own sudden shock into the best disassembling he could manage.
It probably was at the wrong level to fool Professor Quirrell, but Harry certainly couldn't take time to think before replying. Oh, wait, but how on earth would Professor Quirrell know about that? Professor Trelawney made a prophecy.
You were there to hear its beginning, Professor Quirrell said, frowning. You called out to the entire school that the prophecy could not be about you, since you were not coming here. You were already here.
He is coming, the one who will tear apart the very...
And that was as far as Professor Trelawney had gotten before Dumbledore had grabbed her and vanished.
Oh, that prophecy, Harry said. Sorry, it went clear out of my mind.
Harry thought he'd put too much force into the end statement and was 80% expecting Professor Quirrell to say,
"Aha! Now, Mr. Potter, what is this mysterious other prophecy you went to such lengths to deny?" "That is foolish," the defense professor said sharply. "If indeed you are telling me the truth, prophecies are not trivial things. I have racked my brain much over the little that I heard, but such a small fragment is simply too little."
"You think the one who's coming is the one who might have framed Hermione?"
said Harry, as his mind allocated yet another hypothesis,
uncertain predicate referent, "he who is coming."
"With no offence meant to Miss Granger,"
the defence professor said with another frown,
"her life or death does not seem that important. But someone was to come. One who, in your interpretation, was not already there, and someone so significant and unknown as a player, who knows what else they may have done."
Harry nodded, and mentally sighed, because he was going to have to redo his Lord Voldemort odds calculation with yet another piece of evidence in the mix. Professor Quirrell spoke with eyes half-lidded, looking out like through slits.
"More than the question of whom the prophecy spoke, who was meant to hear it? It is said that fates are spoken to those with the power to cause them or avert them. Dumbledore, myself, you, as a distant fourth, Severus Snape. But of those four, Dumbledore and Snape would often be in Trelawney's presence. You and I are the ones who would not have spent much time around her before that Sunday. I think it quite likely that the prophecy was meant for one of us, before Dumbledore took the prophetess away. Did the headmaster say nothing more to you?"
Professor Quirrell's voice was demanding now.
"I thought I heard too much force in that denial, Mr. Potter."
"Honestly, no," Harry said. "It had, honestly, slipped clear out of my mind."
"Then I am rather put out with him,"
Professor Quirrell said softly.
"In fact, I think that I am angry."
Harry said nothing. He didn't even sweat. It might have been a poor reason for confidence, but on this particular score, Harry did happen to be innocent. Professor Quirrell nodded once, sharply, as though in acknowledgement.
"If there is nothing more to say between us, Mr. Potter, you may go."
"I can think of one other suspect,"
Harry said.
"Someone you didn't put on your list at all. Would you analyze him to me, Professor?"
There was another of those moments of silence that was almost a sound in itself.
"As for that suspect," the defense professor said softly, "I think you shall prosecute him on your own, Mr. Potter, without help from me. I have heard such requests before, and experience leads me to refuse. Either I will do too good a job of prosecuting myself and convince you that I am guilty, or else you will decide that my prosecution was too half-hearted and that I am guilty. I will remark only this in my defense, that I would have needed a very good reason indeed to jeopardize your fragile alliance with the heir to House Malfoy.
Hypothesis. The Defense Professor. April 8th, 1992, 8:37 p.m.
So, I fear I must take my leave,
Dumbledore was saying gravely.
I promised Quirinus, that is to say, I promised the Defense Professor that I would not make any attempt to uncover his true identity, in my own person or any other.
And why'd you make a foolish promise like that, then?
Snapped Mad-Eye Moody.
It was an unalterable condition of his employment, or so he said.
Dumbledore glanced at Professor McGonagall, a wry smile briefly flitting over his face.
And Minerva made it clear to me that Hogwarts required a competent defense professor this year, even if I had to haul Grindelwald out of Nurmengard and prevail on old affections to persuade him to take the position.
I did not quite phrase it in that fashion.
Your expression said it for you, my dear.
And so soon, the four of them, Harry, Professor McGonagall, the Potions Master, and Alastair Moody, a.k.a. Mad-Eye, were ensconced all by themselves in the Headmaster's office. It was strange how the Headmaster's office seemed unbalanced without the Headmaster in it. If you didn't have the ancient, wizened Master to make it all seem solemn, you were just four people trying to have a serious meeting while surrounded by bizarre, noisy gidgets. Clearly visible from where Harry had perched himself on his chair arm was a truncated, conical object, like a cone with its top snipped off, slowly spinning around a pulsating central light which it shaded but didn't obscure, and each time the inner light pulsated, the assembly made a vroop, vroop, vroop sound that sounded oddly distant, muffled, like it was coming from behind four solid walls, even though the spinning conical section thingy was only a meter or two away. Vroop, vroop, vroop. And then there were the various still breathing bodies of Harry Potter he'd stashed in one quiet corner, cleaning up a mess that was his own in more ways than one. Only one body wasn't inside a copy of the invisibility cloak, but then it merely took a small effort of concentration for Harry to perceive his other selves beneath the cloak of which he was the master, an effort which Harry had carefully not put forth earlier, to avoid getting advanced temporal information he wanted to determine by his own decision. The sad thing was that by this point, having his own body visibly lying in a corner didn't seem all that crazy. It was just Hogwarts.
All right, then,
Moody said, looking rather sour about it. From within his leather armor, the scarred man took out a black folder.
This is a copy of what Amelia's people put together. She almost certainly knows we've got it, but it's all off the books. That clear? Anyway.
And Moody told them who the Department of Magical Law Enforcement thought Quirinus Quirrell really was. A seemingly ordinary Hogwarts student, though talented enough that he'd been only narrowly beaten out for the head boy position, who'd gone vacating in Albania after his graduation, disappeared, returned after 25 years, and then been caught up in the Wizarding War.
"It was murdering the House of Monroe that made Voldy's name," Moody said. "Until then, he was just another dark wizard with delusions of grandeur and Bellatrix Black. But after that..."
Moody snorted.
"Every fool in the country flocked to serve him. You would have hoped the Wizengamot would turn serious once they realized Voldy was willing to kill their own sacred selves. And that's just what the bastards did. Hope that some other bastard would turn serious. None of the cowards wanted to step in front. It was Monroe, Crouch, Bones, and Longbottom. That was nearly everyone in the ministry who'd dare say a word that might give Voldy offence."
"That was how your house came to be ennobled, Mr. Potter,"
injected the solemn voice of Professor McGonagall.
"There is an ancient lore that if anyone ends a most ancient house, whoever avenges that blood will be made noble. To be sure, the House of Potter was already older than some lines call ancient, but yours was titled A Noble House of Britain after the end of the war, in recognition that you had avenged the most ancient house of Monroe."
"Flush of gratitude and all that,"
Mad-Eye Moody said sourly.
"It didn't last, but at least James and Lily got a fancy title and a useless medal to take to their graves. But that's leaving out 8 years of complete horror after Monroe disappeared, and Regulus Black. He was Monroe's private source in the Death Eaters, we're pretty sure. Was executed by Voldy. Like a dam breaking, and gore flooded out, drowning the whole country. Albus Bloody Dumbledore himself had to step into Monroe's shoes, and that was barely enough for us to survive."
Harry listened with an odd sense of unreality. Some of it felt right, matched up with observation, especially with the speech Professor Quirrell had made before Christmas. And yet, this was Professor Quirrell they were talking about.
"So, that's who the department thinks your defense professor is,"
Mad-Eye Moody finished up his account.
"Now, what do you think, son?"
"Well," Harry said slowly,
"it's also possible to have a mask behind the mask. The obvious next thought is that this David Monroe person died in the war after all, and this is just someone else pretending to be David Monroe, pretending to be Quirinus Quirrell."
"That's obvious," said Professor McGonagall. "Dear Merlin."
"Really, boy?"
said Mad-Eye Moody, his blue eye spinning rapidly.
"I'd say that's a little paranoid."
"You don't know Professor Quirrell,"
Harry did not say.
"It's an easy theory to test,"
Harry said out loud.
"Just check whether the defense professor remembers something about the war that the real David Monroe would have known. Though I suppose if he's playing the part of David Monroe pretending to be someone else, he has a good excuse to pretend he's pretending he doesn't know what you're talking about."
"A little paranoid,"
said the scarred man, his voice rising.
"Not paranoid enough. Constant vigilance. Think about it, lad. What if the real David Monroe never came back from Albania?"
There was a pause.
"I see," Harry said.
"Of course you do,"
Professor McGonagall said.
"Don't mind me, please. I'll just sit here quietly going mad."
"In this line of work, if you survive, you learn that there's 3 kinds of dark wizards,"
Moody said grimly. His wand wasn't pointed at anyone, it was angled slightly downward, but it was in his hand. It had never left his hand since the moment he'd entered the room.
"There's dark wizards that have 1 name. There's dark wizards that have 2 names. And there's dark wizards that change names like you and I change clothes. I saw Munro go through 3 Death Eaters like he was snapping twigs. There's not many wizards that good at age 45. Dumbledore, maybe, but not many others."
"Perhaps that is true," said the potions master from where he was lurking. "But what of it, Mad-Eye? Whatever his identity, Munro was surely the Dark Lord's enemy. I've heard Death Eaters curse his name even after they thought him dead. They feared him well."
"So far as defense professors are concerned,"
Professor McGonagall said primly,
"I shall take it and be grateful."
Moody swung around to glare at her.
"Just where the devil was Munro all those years he was gone, eh? Maybe he thought he could make a name for himself in Britain by exposing Voldy, and vanished away when he found out he was wrong. Then why'd he come back now, huh? What's his new plan?"
Harry ventured tentatively.
"He says he always wanted to be a great defense professor because all the best fighting wizards have taught at Hogwarts, and he kind of is being an incredibly good defense professor, actually. I mean, if he just wanted to keep up a disguise, he could get away with much sloppier work."
Professor McGonagall was nodding firmly.
"Naive," Moody said flatly. "I suppose you all haven't wondered if your defense professor set up the whole House of Munro to be wiped out."
"What?"
cried Professor McGonagall.
"Our ministry wizard hears about a missing kid from a most ancient house of Britain," Moody said. "Steps into the shoes of David Munro, but stays away from the real Munro family. But eventually, the house is bound to notice something wrong. So this imposter somehow prods Voldy into wiping them all out. Maybe leaked a password they'd given him for their wards. And then he was a lord of the Wizengamot."
There seemed to be a fight going on inside Harry's mind between Hufflepuff 1, who'd never trusted the defense professor in the first place, and Hufflepuff 2, who was far too loyal to Harry's friend, Professor Quirrell, to believe something like that just because Moody said so.
"It is kind of obvious, though," observed his Slytherin part. "I mean, do you actually believe that, under natural circumstances, anyone would end up as the last heir to a most ancient house, and Lord Voldemort killed his family, and he has to avenge his martial arts sensei? If anything, I'd say he went too far over the top in setting up his new identity as the ideal literary hero. That sort of thing doesn't happen in real life. This from an orphan who was raised unaware of his heritage,"
commented Harry's inner critic,
"with a prophecy about him. You know, I don't think we've ever read a story about 2 equally destined heroes competing to see who's cliché enough to take down the villain." "Yes," replied the central Harry over the distant vrooping noise in the background.
"It's a very sad life we lead, and you're not helping."
"There's only one thing to do at this point," said Ravenclaw, "and we all know what it is. So why argue?" "But," Harry replied, "how do we test experimentally whether or not Professor Quirrell is the original David Munro? I mean, what sort of observable behaves differently depending on whether he's the real David Munro or an imposter?"
"What do you want me to do about it, Murder A?"
Professor McGonagall was demanding.
"I can't."
"You can,"
the scarred man said, glaring at her fiercely.
"Just fire the bloody defense, Professor."
"You see that every year," said Professor McGonagall.
"Yes, and I'm always right."
"Constant vigilance or no, Alistair, the students must be taught."
Moody snorted.
"Pah! I swear the curse gets worse every year, as you lot get more and more reluctant to let them go. Your precious Professor Quirrell would have to be Grindelwald in disguise to get himself sent off."
"Is he?"
Harry couldn't help asking.
"I mean, could he actually be?"
"I check Grindy's cell every 2 months," Moody said. "He was there in March."
"Could the person in the cell be a ringer?"
"I administer a blood test for his identity, son."
"Where do you keep the blood you use as a reference?"
"In a safe place."
Something like a smile was stretching the scarred lips.
"Have you considered the Aura office after you graduate?"
"Alistair,"
Professor McGonagall said reluctantly.
"The defense professor does have a health condition. I suppose you'll call it suspicious in itself, but it is by no means certain that it will be any ill-doing on his part which prevents us from renewing his employment."
"Yes, his little nap times,"
Moody said darkly.
"Amelia thinks he stepped into the path of a high-level curse. Sounds to me more like a dark ritual gone wrong."
"You've no proof of that,"
Professor McGonagall said.
"That man might as well be wearing a sign saying, 'Dark Wizard,' in glowing letters over his head."
"Ah,"
Harry said. It didn't seem like an especially good time to ask what Mr. Moody thought of the "not all sacrificial rituals are evil" standpoint.
"Excuse me, but you said earlier that Professor Quirrell, the old David Munro, the Munro from the 70s, anyway, you said that person used the killing curse. What does that imply? Does somebody have to be a dark wizard to use it?"
Moody shook his head.
"I've used it myself. All it takes is power, and a certain mood."
The grimacing lips were showing teeth.
"The first time I cast it was against a wizard named Gerald Grice, and you can ask me what he did after you graduate Hogwarts."
"But why is it unforgivable, then?"
Harry said.
"A cutting hex can kill someone too, so why is it any better to use a reducto instead of a varlicata—"
"Shut your mouth!"
Moody said sharply.
"Someone might take it the wrong way. You're saying that incantation. You look too young to cast it, but there's such a thing as polyjuice. And to answer your question, boy, there's two reasons why that spell is in the blackest book. The first is that the killing curse strikes directly at the soul, and he'll just keep on going until it hits one. Straight through shields, straight through walls,
There's a reason why even Ara's fighting Death Eaters weren't allowed to use it before the Monroe Act.
Ah, said Harry. That does seem like an excellent reason to ban...
Oh, I'm not finished, son. The second reason is that the killing curse doesn't just take a powerful bit of magic. You've got to mean it. You've got to want someone dead. And not for the greater good, either. Killing Grice didn't bring back Blair Rush or Nathan Rafus or David Capito. It wasn't for justice, nor to stop him doing it again. I wanted him dead. You understand now, lad. You don't have to be a dark wizard to use that spell. But you can't be Albus Dumbledore, either. And if you're arrested for killing with it, there's no possible defence.
I see, murmured the boy who lived. You can't want the person dead as an instrumental value on the way to some positive future consequence. You can't cast it if you believe it's a necessary evil. You have to actually want them dead for the sake of being dead as a terminal value in your utility function. A magically embodied preference for death over life, striking with the plane of pure life force. That does sound like a difficult spell to block.
Not difficult, Moody snapped. Impossible.
Harry nodded gravely.
But David Monroe, or whoever, used the killing curse against a couple of Death Eaters even before they wiped out his family. Does that mean he already had to hate them? Like the martial arts story was probably true?
Moody shook his head slightly.
One of the dark truths of the killing curse, son, is that once you've cast it the first time, it doesn't take much hate to do it again.
It damages the mind.
Again, Moody shook his head.
No, it's the killing that does that. Murder tears the soul, but that's just the same if it's a cutting hex. The killing curse doesn't crack your soul. It just takes a cracked soul to cast.
If there was a sad expression on the scarred face, it could not be read.
But that doesn't tell us much about Monroe. The ones like Dumbledore who'll never be able to cast the curse all their lives, because they never crack, no matter what. They're the rare ones. Very rare. It only takes a little cracking.
There was a strange, heavy feeling in Harry's chest. He wondered what exactly it had meant, that Lily Potter had tried to cast the killing curse at Lord Voldemort with her last breath. But surely it was forgivable. It was right and proper for a mother to hate the dark wizard who was coming to kill her baby, mocking her for how she couldn't stop him. There was something wrong with you as a parent if you couldn't cast Avada Kedavra in that situation. And no other spell could have gone past the Dark Lord's shields. You'd have to at least try to hate the Dark Lord enough to want him dead for the sake of dead, if that was the only way to save your baby.
It only takes a little cracking.
Enough, said Professor McGonagall. What would you have us do?
Moody's smile twisted.
Get rid of the defense, Professor, and see if all your troubles mysteriously clean up. Bet you a galleon they do.
Professor McGonagall looked like she was in pain.
Alistair, but will you teach the classes if...
Ha!
said Moody.
"If I ever say yes to that question, check me for polyjuice, because it's not me."
"I'll test it experimentally," Harry said, and then, as everyone looked at him, "I'll ask Professor Quirrell a question that the real David Munro would know, like who else was in the Slytherin class of 1945, or something like that, hopefully without making it obvious. It won't be definitive proof. He could have studied the role, but it would be evidence. Still, Mr. Moody, even if Professor Quirrell isn't the original Munro, I'm not sure that getting rid of him is a free action. He saved my life twice."
"What?" demanded Moody. "When? How?"
"Once when he knocked down a bunch of witches who were summoning me toward the ground. Once when he figured out that the Dementor was draining me through my wand. And if Professor Quirrell wasn't the one who set up Draco Malfoy in the first place, then he saved Draco Malfoy's life. And things would be a lot worse if he hadn't. If the defense professor isn't behind it all, he's not someone we can afford to just get rid of."
Professor McGonagall nodded firmly. Hypothesis: Severus Snape, April 8th, 1992, 9:03 p.m. Harry and Professor McGonagall now stood on the slowly turning stairs, turning without descending. Or at least one Harry stood upon those stairs. His other three selves had been left behind in the headmaster's office.
"Can I ask you a private question?" Harry said, when he thought they were far enough away not to be heard. "And in particular, private from the headmaster?"
"Yes?"
Professor McGonagall said, not quite sighing.
"No, I hope you realize that I cannot do anything which conflicts with my duties to..."
"Yes," Harry said. "That's exactly what I need to ask you about. In front of the Wizengamot, when Lucius Malfoy was saying that Hermione was no part of House Potter and that he wouldn't take the money, you told Hermione how to swear that oath. I want to know, if something like that comes up again, if your first duty is to the Hogwarts student, Hermione Granger, or to the head of the Order of the Phoenix, Albus Dumbledore." Professor McGonagall looked like someone had hit her in the face with a cast-iron frying pan a few minutes earlier, and now she'd been told that somebody was about to do it again, and not to flinch. Harry flinched a little himself. Somewhere along the line, he needed to pick up the knack of not phrasing things to hit as hard as he possibly could. The walls rotated around them, behind them, and somehow they descended.
"Ugh, Mr. Potter,"
Professor McGonagall said with a low exhalation.
"I wish you wouldn't ask me such questions. Oh, Harry, I wasn't thinking then. Not at all. I only saw a chance to help Miss Granger, and I was sorted into Gryffindor, after all."
"You've got a chance to think now," Harry said. It was all coming out wrong, but he had to say it anyway, because... "I'm not asking you to be loyal to me, but if you do know, if you are sure, what you'll do if it comes down to an innocent Hogwarts student versus the Order of the Phoenix a second time?"
But Professor McGonagall shook her head.
"I'm not sure,"
the Transfiguration Professor whispered.
"I don't know if it was the right choice even then. I'm sorry. I can't decide such awful things.
But you'll do something if it happens again,
Harry said.
Indecision is also a choice. You can't just imagine having to make an immediate decision.
No,
Professor McGonagall said, sounding a little stronger, and Harry realized that he'd accidentally offered a way out. The professor's next words confirmed Harry's fears.
Such a dreadful choice is that, Mr. Potter. I think I should not make it, until I must.
Harry gave an internal sigh. He supposed he had no right to expect Professor McGonagall to say anything else. In a moral dilemma where you lost something either way, making the choice would feel bad either way. So you could temporarily save yourself a little mental pain by refusing to decide. At the cost of not being able to plan anything in advance, and at the cost of incurring a huge bias toward inaction or waiting until too late. But you couldn't expect a witch to know all that.
All right, Harry said, though it wasn't right at all. Not really.
Dumbledore might want the debt removed. Professor Quirrell would also want Harry out of that debt. And if the defense professor was David Munro, or could convincingly appear to be David Munro, then Lord Voldemort technically hadn't exterminated the House of Munro, in which case somebody might be able to pass a Wizengamot resolution revoking the noble status of House Potter, which had been granted for avenging the most ancient House of Munro. In which case, Hermione's vow of service to a noble house might be null and void. Or maybe not. Harry didn't know anything about the legalities, especially not whether House Potter got the money back if someone managed to send Hermione to Azkaban. Just because you lost something might not mean the payment was returned, legally speaking. Harry wasn't sure, and he didn't dare ask a magical solicitor. It would have been nice to be able to trust at least one adult to take Hermione's side instead of Dumbledore's, if an issue like that threatened to come up. The stairs they were upon ceased rotating, and they were before the backs of the great stone gargoyles which rumbled aside, revealing the hallway. Harry stepped out. A hand caught at Harry's shoulder.
"Mr. Potter,"
Professor McGonagall said in a low voice.
"Why did you tell me to keep watch over Professor Snape?"
Harry turned around again.
"You told me to keep watch and see if he'd changed,"
Professor McGonagall went on, her tone urgent.
"Why did you say that, Mr. Potter?"
It took a moment at this point for Harry to think back and remember why he had said that. Harry and Neville had rescued Lasarth Lestrange from bullies, and then Harry had confronted Severus in the hallway and, at least according to the potions master's own words, almost died.
"I learned something that made me worry,"
Harry said after a moment.
"From someone who made me promise not to tell anyone else."
Severus had made Harry swear that their conversations wouldn't be shared with anyone, and Harry was still bound by it.
"Mr. Potter,"
began Professor McGonagall, and then exhaled, the flash of sharpness disappearing as quickly as it had come.
"Never mind. If you cannot say, you cannot say."
"Why do you ask?"
Harry said. Professor McGonagall seemed to hesitate.
"All right, let me be more specific," Harry said.
After Professor Quirrell had done it to him several times, Harry was starting to get the hang of it.
"What change have you already observed in Professor Snape that you're trying to decide whether to tell me about?"
"Harry,"
the Transfiguration Professor said, and then closed her mouth.
"I obviously know something you don't," Harry said helpfully. "See, this is why we can't always put off trying to decide our awful moral dilemmas."
Professor McGonagall closed her eyes, drew in a deep breath, pinched the bridge of her nose, and squeezed it several times.
"All right," she said. "It's a subtle thing, but worrying. How can I put this? Mr. Potter, have you read many books that young children are not meant to read?"
"I've read all of them."
"Of course you have. Well, I don't quite understand it myself, but for so long as Severus has been employed in this school, stalking about in that awful stained cloak, there's been a certain sort of girl that stares at him with longing eyes."
"You say that like it's a bad thing," Harry said. "I mean, if there's one thing I did understand from those books, it's that you're not supposed to question people's preferences."
Professor McGonagall gave Harry a very strange look.
"I mean," Harry said, "from what I understand, when I'm a bit older, there's something like a 10% chance that I'll find Professor Snape attractive, and the important thing for me is to just accept whatever I..."
"In any case, Mr. Potter, Severus has always been entirely indifferent to the stares of those young girls, but now..."
Professor McGonagall seemed to realize something and hastily said, her hands rising in warning,
"Please don't mistake me. Professor Snape certainly has not taken advantage of any young witches. Absolutely not. He's never even so much as smiled at one, not that I ever heard. He's told the young girls to stop gaping at him, and if they stare at him regardless, he looks away. That I have seen with my own eyes."
Harry said. "Sorry, but just because I've read those books doesn't mean I understood them. What does all that mean?"
"That he is noticing,"
Professor McGonagall said in a low voice.
"It is a subtle thing, but now that I've seen it, I am certain. And that means, I'm very much afraid, that the bond which held Severus to Albus's cause may have weakened or even broken."
2 + 2 =
"Snape and Dumbledore?"
Then Harry heard the words that had just come out of his mouth and hastily added,
"Not that there's anything wrong with that."
"No,"
said Professor McGonagall.
"Oh, for pity's sake, I can't explain it to you, Mr. Potter."
The other shoe finally dropped.
"He was still in love with my mother?"
This seemed somewhere between beautifully sad and pathetic for around 5 seconds before the third shoe dropped.
"Of course, that was before I gave him my helpful relationship advice." "I see,"
Harry said carefully after a few moments. There were times when saying, "Oops," didn't fully cover it.
"You're right. That's not a good sign."
Professor McGonagall put both hands over her face.
"Whatever you're thinking right now,"
she said in a slightly muffled voice,
"which I assure you is also wrong, I don't want to hear about it. Ever."
So, Harry said, "if, like you said, the bond that held Professor Snape to the headmaster has broken, what would he do then?"
There was a long silence.
"What would he do then?"
Minerva lowered her hands, gazing down at the upturned face of the boy who lived. One simple question shouldn't have caused her so much dismay. She had known Severus for years, the two of them bound, in some strange way, by the prophecy they'd both heard. Though Minerva suspected, from what she knew of the rules of prophecy, that she had only overheard it herself. It had been Severus's act which had brought about the prophecy's fulfilment, and the guilt, the heartbreak, which had come of that choice, had been tormenting the potions master for years. She couldn't imagine who Severus would be without it. Her mind went blank trying to imagine, her thoughts an empty parchment. Surely Severus was no longer the man he'd once been, that angry and terribly foolish young man who'd brought the prophecy before Voldemort in exchange for being admitted into the Death Eaters. She had known him for years, and surely Severus was no longer that man. Did she really know him at all? Had anyone ever seen the real Severus Snape?
"I don't know,"
Professor McGonagall finally said.
"I truly don't know at all. I can't even imagine. Do you know anything of this, Mr. Potter?"
Said Harry. "I think I can say that my own evidence points in the same direction as yours. I mean, it increases the probability that Professor Snape isn't in love with my mother anymore."
Professor McGonagall closed her eyes.
"I give up."
"I don't know of anything wrong he's done apart from that, though,"
Harry added.
"I assume the headmaster cleared you to ask me about this."
Professor McGonagall looked away from him, staring at the wall.
"Please, don't, Harry."
"All right," Harry said, and turned and hurried out into the hallways, hearing Professor McGonagall more slowly walking after, and the rumbling sound of the gargoyles moving into place.
It was the morning after next, during potions class, that Harry's potion of cold resistance boiled over his cauldron with a green, frothy, and mildly nauseating smell, and Professor Snape, looking more resigned than disgusted, told Harry to stay after class. Harry had his own suspicions about this affair, and as soon as class let out, Hermione, as usual for the last few days, being the first to flee out the door, the door swung shut and locked behind the departing students.
"I apologize for ruining your potion, Mr. Potter," Severus Snape said quietly.
There was upon his face the strange, sad look that Harry had seen only once before, in a hallway some time ago.
"It will not be reflected in your grades. Please sit down."
Harry sat back down at his desk, filling up the time by scrubbing a bit more at the green stain on the wooden surface, as the potions master incanted a few privacy spells. When the potions master was done, he spoke again.
"I do not know how to broach this topic, Mr. Potter. So I will simply say it. Before the Dementor, you recovered your memory of the night your parents died?"
Harry silently nodded.
"If... no, it must not be a pleasant memory, but... if... you could tell me what happened?"
Why? Harry said. His voice was solemn, definitely not mocking the pleading look that Harry had never expected to see from that person.
"I wouldn't think that would be a pleasant thing for you to hear either, Professor."
The potions master's voice was almost a whisper.
"I have imagined it every night these last 10 years.
"You know," said Harry Slytherin sighed, "it might not be such a good idea to give him closure, if his guilt-based loyalties are already wavering." "Shut up! Overruled!"
It wasn't something that Harry could actually bring himself to deny. He took one suggestion from his Slytherin side, and that was it.
"Will you tell me exactly how you came to learn about the prophecy?"
Harry said.
"I'm sorry to make this a trade. I will tell you afterward, only it could be really important."
"There is little to say. I had come to be interviewed by the deputy headmistress for the position of potions master, and so I was waiting outside the room of the Hogshead Inn, where the applicant before me, Sybil Trelawney, came to seek the position of Professor of Divination. As soon as Trelawney finished speaking her words, I fled, forsaking my chance at Hogwarts's mastery, and went to the Dark Lord."
The potions master's face was drawn and tight.
"I did not even pause to consider why that riddle might have come to me before I sold it to another."
"A job interview?"
Harry said.
"Where you and Professor Trelawney both happened to be applying, and Professor McGonagall was interviewing? That seems, like rather a large coincidence."
"Seers are the pawns of time, Mr. Potter. Coincidence is beneath them, and they are above it. I was the one meant to hear that prophecy and become its fool. Minerva's presence made no final difference to how it came about. There was no memory charm, as you supposed. I do not know why you thought that, but there was no memory charm. There could have been no memory charm. The voice of a seer has a quality, an enigma, which even legitimacy cannot share. How could that be imbued in a false memory? Do you think the Dark Lord would believe my mere words? The Dark Lord seized my mind and saw the mystification there. Even if he could not seize the mystery, and so he knew the prophecy had been true. The Dark Lord could have killed me then, having taken what he wanted. I was a fool indeed to go to him. But he saw something in me, I do not know, and took me into the Death Eaters, though on his terms. rather than mine. That is how I brought it about. Brought it all about. From beginning to end. Always my own doing.
Severus's voice had gone rather hoarse, and his face was filled with naked pain.
Now tell me, please, how did Lily die?
Harry swallowed twice and began his recounting.
James Potter shouted for Lily to run away with me, that he would hold off you-know-who. You-know-who said...
Harry stopped, the chills going all over his own skin as his own muscles tightened as if preparing for a seizure. The memory was returning strongly now, accompanied by cold and darkness in association.
He used the killing curse, and then he came upstairs somehow. I think he must have flown. I don't remember any footsteps on stairs or anything like that. And then my mother said, "No, not Harry. Please, not Harry." Or something like that. And the Dark Lord. His voice was so high, like water whistling out of a tea kettle, only cold. The Dark Lord said, "Stand aside, woman. For you I am not come. Only the boy."
The words were very clear in Harry's memory.
He told my mother to get out of his way, that he was only there for me. And my mother begged him to have mercy, and the Dark Lord said, "I give you this rare chance to flee." That he was being generous and giving her a chance to run. But he wouldn't bother fighting her, and even if she died, she couldn't save me.
Harry's voice was unsteady.
And so she ought to get out of his way. And that was when my mother begged the Dark Lord to take her life instead of mine. And the Dark Lord said to her, and his voice was lower this time, like he was dropping a pose, "Very well, I accept the bargain." He said that he accepted her offer, and that she should drop her wand so he could kill her. And then the Dark Lord waited. Just waited. I don't know what Lily Potter was thinking. It hadn't even made sense in the first place, what she said. It wasn't like the Dark Lord would kill her and then just leave when he'd come there for me. Lily Potter didn't say anything, and then the Dark Lord started laughing at her. It was horrible, and she finally tried the only thing left that wasn't abandoning me or just giving up and dying. I don't know if she even could have, if the spell would have worked for her, but when you think about it, she had to try. The last thing my mother said was, "Evada," but the Dark Lord started his own curse as soon as she said "Av," and he said it in less than half a second, and there was a flash of green light, and then...
"That's enough."
Slowly, like a body floating to the surface of water, Harry returned from wherever he'd been.
"That's enough,"
the potions master said hoarsely.
"She died. Lily died without pain, then. The Dark Lord did not do anything to her before she died?"
"She died thinking that she had failed, and that the Dark Lord was going to kill her baby next. That's pain. The Dark Lord didn't torture her, Harry said. If that's what you're asking.
Behind Harry, the door unlocked itself and swung open. Harry left. It was Friday, April 10th of 1992. Chapter 87. Hedonic Awareness. Thursday, April 16th, 1992. The school was almost deserted now, 9/10 of the students having gone home for the Easter holiday, just about everyone she knew missing. Susan had stayed behind, her grand aunt being quite busy, as had Ron for reasons she didn't know. Maybe the Weasley family was poor enough that feeding all the children for an extra week would have been a noticeable strain? It all worked out well enough, since Ron and Susan were just about the only ones left who'd still talk to her. At least, that she wanted to talk back to. Lavender was still nice to her, and Tracy was... Tracy. But neither of them were quite relaxing to spend a free hour around. And in any case, neither of those two had stayed over for the Easter holidays. If she couldn't go home, and she wasn't allowed to go home, her parents had been lied to and told she had glowpox. Then an almost empty Hogwarts was the next best thing. She could even visit the library without people staring at her, since there were no lessons and nobody was trying to do schoolwork. It would be a mistake to think that Hermione drooped about the corridors weeping all day long. No, she had cried a lot the first 2 days, of course, but 2 days had been enough. There were parts of Harry's borrowed books about that. How even people who were paralysed in car accidents weren't nearly as unhappy as they'd expected to be 6 months later, just like lottery winners weren't nearly as happy as they'd expected. People adjusted. Their happiness levels went back to their happiness set point. Life went on. A shadow fell over where Hermione was reading her current book, and she whirled around, the wand hidden on her lap, coming up to point directly at the surprised face of...
Sorry...
Harry Potter said, hastily holding up his palms to show his left hand empty and his right hand holding a small, red, velvet pouch.
"Sorry, didn't mean to startle you."
There was an awful silence, her heartbeat increasing and her palms starting to sweat as Harry Potter just looked at her. She had almost talked to him on the first morning of the rest of her life, but when she'd come down to breakfast, Harry Potter had looked so awful. So she hadn't sat down beside him at the breakfast table, just quietly eaten in her own little bubble of nobody else sitting next to her, and it had been horrible. But Harry hadn't come to her, and... she just hadn't talked to him since then. It wasn't hard to avoid everyone if you stayed out of the Ravenclaw common room and ran out of classes before anyone could talk to you. And ever since, she had been wondering what Harry thought of her now. If he hated her for having lost all his money, or if he really was in love with her, and that's why he'd done it. Or if he'd given up on her keeping pace with him because she couldn't frighten Dementors. She couldn't face him now. She just couldn't. She spent sleepless nights worrying what Harry thought of her now, and she was afraid. And she'd been avoiding the boy who'd spent all his money to save her, and she was a horrible, ungrateful wretch, and a terrible person, and... And then her eyes glanced down to see that Harry was reaching into the red velvet pouch and taking out a heart-shaped, red, foil-wrapped sweet, and her brain melted down like chocolate left out in the sun.
"I was going to give you more space," said Harry Potter. "Only I was reading up on Critch's theories about hedonics and how to train your inner pigeon and how small immediate positive and negative feedback secretly control most of what we actually do, and it occurred to me that you might be avoiding me because seeing me made you think of things that felt like negative associations, and I really didn't want to let that run any longer without doing something about it. So I got a hold of a bag of chocolates from the Weasley twins, and I'm just going to give you one every time you see me as a positive reinforcement, if that's all right with you."
"Breathe, Harry,"
Hermione said without thinking about it. It was the first word she'd spoken to him since the day of the trial. The two of them stared at each other. The books stared at them from the surrounding shelves. They stared some more at each other.
"You're supposed to eat the chocolate,"
Harry said, holding out the heart-shaped sweet like a valentine.
"Unless just being given a chocolate feels good enough to count as a positive reinforcement, in which case you probably need to put it in your pocket or something."
She knew that if she tried speaking again, she'd fail. So, she didn't try. Harry's head slumped a bit.
"Do you hate me now?"
"No, you shouldn't think that, Harry. Just everything."
She realized that her wand was still pointed at Harry, and she lowered it. She was trying very hard not to burst out into tears.
"Everything,"
she repeated, and couldn't find anything better to say than that, although she was certain that Harry wanted to tell her to be specific.
"I think I understand," Harry said cautiously. What are you reading?"
Before she could stop him, Harry bent over the library desk to see the book she was reading, leaning his head forward before she could think to grab the book away. Harry stared at the open page.
"The World's Wealthiest Wizards and How They Got That Way,"
Harry read off the book's title from the top.
"Number 65, Sir Gareth, owner of a transportation company that won the 19th century shipping wars. Monopoly on OT3s. I see."
"I suppose you're going to tell me that I don't need to worry about anything, and you'll take care of it all?"
It came out sounding harsher than she would have wanted, and she felt another stab of guilt for being such a terrible person.
"Nah,"
Harry said, sounding oddly cheerful.
"I can put myself in your shoes well enough to know that if you paid a bunch of money to save me, I'd be trying to pay it back. I'd know it was silly on some level, and I'd still be trying to pay it back all myself. There's no way I wouldn't understand that, Hermione."
Hermione's face screwed up, and she felt moisture in the corner of her eyes.
"Fair warning, though," Harry went on. "I might solve the debt to Lucius Malfoy myself if I see a way before you do. It's more important to get that sorted immediately than which one of us gets it sorted. Anything interesting so far?"
Three quarters of her was running in circles and smashing into trees as she tried to figure out the implications of everything Harry had just said. Did he still respect her as a heroine, or did that mean he thought she couldn't do it on her own? And meanwhile, a much more sensible part of Hermione flipped back the book to page 37, which had the most promising entry she'd seen so far. Though, in her imagination, she always did it on her own, and took Harry completely by surprise.
"I thought this seemed quite interesting,"
her voice said.
"Number 14. Crozier. True name unknown," Harry read. "Wow, that is the gaudiest checkered top hat I've ever seen. Wealth, at least 600,000 galleons, so around £30 million. Not enough to make a muggle famous, but good enough for the smaller wizard population, I guess. Rumoured to be a modern alias of the 6th-century-old Nicholas Flamel, the only known wizard to succeed at the incredibly difficult alchemical procedure for creating the Philosopher's Stone, which enables the transmutation of base metals into gold or silver, as well as the Elixir of Life, which indefinitely prolongs the youth and health of the user. Hermione, this seems obviously false.
I've read more references to Nicholas Flamel,
Hermione said.
The Rise and Fall of the Dark Arts says he secretly trained Dumbledore to stand up to Grindelwald. There's a lot of books that take the story seriously, not just this one. You think it's too good to be true?
No, of course not, said Harry. Harry pulled out the chair next to her own, at the small table, and sat down beside her in his accustomed place on her right, just like he'd never left. She had to choke back a catch in her throat. The idea of too good to be true isn't causal reasoning. The universe doesn't check if the output to the equation is too good or too bad before allowing it. People used to think that airplanes and smallpox vaccines were too good to be true. Muggles have figured out ways to travel to other stars without even using magic, and you and I can use our wands to do things that muggle physicists think are literally impossible. I can't even imagine what we could rule out the real laws of magic being able to do.
So, what's the problem then?
Hermione said. Her voice sounded more normal now in her own ears.
Well,
Harry said. The boy reached over her own outstretched arm, his robes brushing hers, and tapped the artist's illustration of an ominously glowing red stone dripping scarlet liquid.
Problem one is that there's no logical reason why the same artifact would be able to transmute lead to gold and produce an elixir that kept someone young. I wonder if there's an official name for that in the literature. Like, the turned up to 11 effect, maybe. If everyone can see a flower, you can't get away with saying flowers are the size of houses. But if you're in a flying saucer cult, since nobody can see the alien mothership anyway, you can say it's the size of a city, or the size of the moon. Observable things have to be constrained by evidence, but when somebody makes up a story, they can make the story as extreme as they want. So, the Philosopher's Stone gives you unlimited gold and eternal life, not because there's a single magical discovery that would produce both of those effects, but because someone made up a story about a super happy thing.
Harry, there's a lot of things in magic that aren't sensible,
she said.
Granted, said Harry. But Hermione, problem two is that not even wizards are crazy enough to casually overlook the implications of this. Everyone would be trying to rediscover the formula for the Philosopher's Stone. Whole countries would be trying to capture the immortal wizard and get the secret out of him.
It's not a secret.
Hermione flipped the page, showing Harry the diagrams.
The instructions are right on the next page. It's just so difficult that only Nicholas Flamel's done it.
So, entire countries would be trying to kidnap Flamel and force him to make more stones. Come on, Hermione. Even wizards wouldn't hear about immortality and...
Harry Potter paused, his eloquence apparently failing him.
And just keep going. Humans are crazy, but they're not that crazy.
Not everyone thinks the same way you do, Harry.
He did have a point, but how many different references had she come across to Nicholas Flamel? Besides world's wealthiest wizards and rise and fall of the dark arts, there had also been stories of moderately ancient times and biographies of the justly famous.
All right, then. Professor Quirrell would have kidnapped this Flamel guy. It's what an evil person, or a good person who's just a selfish person, would do if they had any sense. The defense professor knows a lot of secrets, and he wouldn't miss that one.
Harry sighed and looked up. She followed his gaze, but he was apparently just looking at the larger library, the rows and rows and rows of bookcases.
"I don't mean to mess with your project," said Harry, "and I certainly don't mean to discourage you, but honestly, Hermione, I'm not sure you're going to find any good ideas for making money in a book like this. Like the old joke about how if an economist sees a £20 note lying in the street, they won't bother picking it up, because if it were real, someone else would have picked it up already. Any way of making lots of money that everyone knows about to the point where it's in books like this... You see what I'm saying? It can't be possible for everyone to make 1,000 galleons a month in 3 easy steps, or everyone would be doing it.
So? That wouldn't stop you?
Hermione said, her voice now roughening again.
You do impossible things all the time. I bet you've done something impossible in the last week, and you didn't bother telling anyone.
There was a slight pause, which, if Miss Granger had known, was exactly the length of pause you'd make if you'd fought Mad-Eye Moody and won exactly 8 days.